So you will need your Bible open at Ecclesiastes. We won't read the whole book. We won't look at every verse, but we will try and do some kind of overview. So it'd be really helpful if you've got that in front of you. I don't know if you've actually, yes, you should have access to your Bible, shouldn't you? So have that Bible open in front of you. And what we're going to try and do is just try and see what the main message of this book is. You can do that really with any book of the Bible. You can take the whole book and you can do a summary and you can ask the question, what is the main point? What's the weight of the message that the writer wants you to see from this book? So if you were just to read the whole thing through once without stopping to look at the details, what would you get from the big picture? And when I first started to look at this 6 or 7 months ago, I didn't really know how to make a start. It just seemed too disconnected or too... it's just unusual as a book, the way it's written, the kind of things it talks about. And at first it didn't seem that obvious to me what the big picture is. But as you read it again and again, you do actually see the same ideas come up again and again and again. So I printed out the whole of the text without the titles, without the verse numbers, just the words, and started to read through it with coloured pens, underlining certain words and certain ideas. And I started to see the same three things emerge. So I'm going to take you through Ecclesiastes, looking at three main themes. And I'm not saying that these are the only things in the book, but I think that somehow they hold together the whole book. But before we look at that, I want to tell you a story from another era and another part of the world. Actually, Joel, you know this story, if you remember the book you had to read this term for school. But in the 1730s, a French geological expedition went to Peru, and they had one thing in mind. They had one task. Back in those days, in that period of history in particular, there was a huge amount of curiosity about the world as a globe and how it worked. They believed in a round earth, unlike everybody today. There are people that still believe in the flat earth. I do not believe in a flat earth. But these French geologists, convinced that the world was round, wanted to know exactly how round it was. In other words, is it exactly round or is it not quite round? Because there were different views on this, and this is because of the opinions of different scientists in different fields in different countries who were saying, well, it can't be perfectly round because of something to do with the way that stones fall off a mountain. I don't know, it's all very confusing and complicated. But these geologists, about 10 or 12 of them, went to Peru because they realized that if they went to a particular part of Peru, up a mountain, they'd be near the equator and they could do certain measurements to do with pressure and temperature and sunrise and sunset, I don't know. And try and figure out, they're cleverer than me, how round the Earth is. They wanted to prove that the world, that the globe was perfectly round. They wanted to prove that. That was their desire. Anyway, off they go to Peru in the 1730s. It's the other side of the world from where they live. And on the way, and during the course of their work and their experiments, all kinds of terrible things happened. Some of them died of illnesses. One of them went insane, probably from the stress and the distance from family and the conditions they were under. One member of the team abandoned the team because he fell in love with a local 13-year-old girl and just disappeared into the jungle. They fell out with each other. By the end, the two leaders were not speaking to each other. They suffered extremes of temperature, heat in the rainforest, and extreme cold up in the mountains. And they stayed in Peru for almost 10 years, conducting their experiments. Now, just before they reached their conclusions, which were that the Earth is not perfectly round, I don't know if you knew that, it is 43 kilometers smaller if you draw a circle around the North and South Poles that way, compared to the equator that way. So it's slightly squashed. It's not important, but it's slightly squashed. That's the conclusion they came to, which is not the conclusion they wanted to come to. But just before they reached it, news reached them that another French expedition had gone to Scandinavia, done the same experiment, and discovered that truth before them. So they'd spent nearly 10 years in Peru, all this suffering. They'd come to the conclusion they did not want to come to, only to find out that some other people had done it way faster than them, without their suffering, without their frustration, without insanity, death, and abandonment. And as I was reading this, I thought, can you imagine coping with that level of frustration and that sense of futility? Giving the best part of your life with your enormous brain to waste your time discovering something you did not want to discover, only to discover that other people had discovered it before you. And it's just a little parable in futility. It's an extreme parable of futility, and none of us probably, I hope, will experience that level, that extreme level of futility and frustration. But it is a truth that every single one of us will, to some degree, experience futility. You know what it's like. You dust your coffee table, and then you turn your back for 30 seconds, you turn back again, and you can see the dust sprinkling back over this perfectly clean, dust-free coffee table. 30 seconds. It's futile. In our house, we vacuum the room not very often, and then by the end of the same day, there's dust bunnies collecting in the corners again. We ask our children to clear the stuff they've left on the staircase, and by the end of the day, there's more stuff left on the staircase. My daughter had a wonderful experience with this yesterday. Well, actually, it wasn't wonderful. She's 9 years old, and she's the kind of person that likes to collect things and arrange things in very special ways. And in her bedroom, she's got this little space between her bed and a piece of furniture where she puts some dolls and some books and a light and goodness knows what. She has to give up her bed for family visiting on tomorrow. So we're saying, Ruth, you've got to clear your room. It's a hard job for her, but she started to clear it, and it just never seemed to get clearer and never seemed to get clearer. So I said to her, okay, you may not do anything else until you've cleared that one section. So I pulled all the stuff out from that gap and said, you've got to put those things away. She started, she thought she'd finished, and I came and inspected it and just looked a little bit deeper, and there were some more things pulled away. So she puts those things away. Another 10 minutes later, come in, look a little bit deeper behind the corner of the bed, there's more stuff to pull out. It's a never-ending process of sorting out and cleaning and dusting, and it never ever finishes. Life's futile, isn't it? Now the conclusion from that obviously is not, well, don't bother tidying, don't bother cleaning. Some people might think that, mentioning no names, but that is not the conclusion that one should come to. But what you have to see, and what Ecclesiastes does beautifully, is that life is futile. It's not my take on it. That's the words of the text itself. Let's just read the opening few lines. They're very, very famous words. Ecclesiastes chapter 1, verse 1. The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem. Vanity of vanities, or I don't know what version you have, meaningless, meaningless. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What does man gain by all the toil at which he toils under the sun? Generation goes and a generation comes, but the earth, which is not exactly round, remains forever. The sun rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it rises. Then the wind and then the streams and then the seas and so on and so on. You could read this book and at the end just want to lie down in a dark room and feel sorry for yourself. That is not the conclusion that will come to you, but you could do that. Some people have said that this is the book for the kind of nihilist philosopher. You know, the kind of person that says, well, meaningless, meaningless, you know, we all die, so there's no point to anything, so just don't bother. It isn't that. The gospel, the good news, is present even in this book. What we're going to do for the remainder of our time is see how this gloomy, gritty, possibly depressing kind of book actually leads us to joy and to good news. It's a part of the Bible that we know as the wisdom literature. And so I think that one thing that you can say straight away is, okay, if this is wisdom literature, then what the writer wants us to do is to become wise people. And in some ways, the summary of the whole thing is, if you see life the way that it really is, then you will be truly wise, truly wise. Wisdom is the result of seeing reality. Or if you want to put it the other way around, if you want to live in a way that doesn't recognize what reality is, you're a fool. So, you want to be wise or foolish? It's an obvious answer, isn't it? Let's go into some of the details of the book. If you read it through yourself, you'll see quite a few little bits of what look like good advice, you know, things to do well, things to do wisely. And so you could think, okay, maybe this is wisdom, because what it does is it teaches you like some tricks for how to live well. Have you ever come across those things? This is a kind of an internet meme kind of thing called life hacks. If you come across life hacks, you'll see people put together lists of little tricks that you can do around the house to make your life better, like what you do with old tea bags, for example. If you've got smelly shoes, old tea bags, put the tea bags in the shoes, takes away the smell. I've never tried it, but apparently it works. That's called a life hack. There are other ones that we know of. If you are camping and you're finding it difficult to start your fire, put some potato chips in the fire, light the potato chips, and the fire will start faster because they're full of oil. It's a life hack. Or when you're cooking pasta, you know how when you turn your back and the pasta boils over, all the water comes out of the pot, lay a wooden spoon across the top of the pot, the water doesn't boil over. I've tried that one, it does work. That's a life hack. Maybe Ecclesiastes is like that. It's just a series of ways to live better. So for example, turn with me to chapter 4 and verse 9. Here is an ecclesiastical life hack, if you like. It says, two are better than one because they have a good reward for their toil. Well, it's good sense, good common sense, isn't it? Don't try and do stuff alone. Deal with a friend, works more easily. Yesterday, Joel and I had to cut up some old bits of furniture to burn in the fireplace because it's rotten and no good to keep, so we cut it together. Much quicker, much easier. Two, better than one. Good. How about chapter 5, verse 1? Here's another life hack, perhaps. Guard your steps when you go to the house of God. To draw near to listen is better than to offer the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they are doing evil. So guard your steps as you're going to the temple. This is advice for the Jewish people. So maybe that's what Ecclesiastes is about. Just, you know, earthly wisdom. Well, yes, for some of it. But then what about these statements? Go to chapter 6, verses 3 to 5. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. What do you do with a statement like that? How does that help me to live wisely? I read it and I think, oh, that's a bit grim. It's a bit dark. What about chapter 7, verse 2? Where he says, it is better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting. For this is the end of all mankind, and the living will lay it to heart. I don't know how that helps me to live more wisely. It's saying, it's better to mourn than to feast. Is it better to be sad than happy? What's going on here? So I don't think that you can read Ecclesiastes and think, the wisdom here is simply the kind of wisdom that is, you know, what to do with old tea bags, but in a religious kind of way. It's darker, it's more perplexing, it's kind of, I think it's more unsettling. And it's supposed to be unsettling. I think you're supposed to read this and go, I'm not quite sure what to do with this. Now, we can only skim it. We can't do loads and loads of details. But as I said earlier, I think that there are three big themes that stand out, which if we look at them, maybe will help us to see what are we supposed to do with this kind of wisdom. Okay? And here are the three things. I'll give you all three, and then we'll go through each one. The first one is vanity. The second one is toil. And the third one is death. Let's just go through each one. Vanity. It's where it starts. Vanity, vanity. All is vanity, or meaningless. And what does he mean by that, do you think? I think it's very simply that although life is real, and although life, it's not an illusion, it's not that we're not really here, but it's that it's fleeting, it passes quickly. You can't hold, it's like trying to hold water in your hand. You know, you try, but you will fail. It trickles out. Vanity, meaningless. Life is vanity, success is vanity, emotions, progress, relationships. Whatever we put our hand to, the preacher says, vanity. Because in the end, either we lose it or we are lost to it. And I think this is part of the kind of punch of the book. Don't pretend that we or our achievements or our name or our reputation are anything more than what they really are, i.e. really not very much. We're small, a few years, a few decades. And after we're gone, most of us won't be remembered for more than a few years, most of us. It's only a few people they get remembered for many, many, many years. There's a hero of mine called Johnny Wilkinson. Now, most of you probably aren't into rugby sport, but Johnny Wilkinson was the hero of the England rugby team about 15 years ago. And he was the star player in 2003 when England won the World Cup final, the Rugby World Cup final in Australia. And in one of the largest stadiums in the world, full of mostly Australians, England beat Australia to land the biggest prize of all. And Johnny Wilkinson was the star. You can look at him on YouTube if you want to. But here's what Johnny Wilkinson says, thinking back to what happened in his mind a few moments, just a few short minutes after the game ended. So glory and fame and achievement. And here's what Johnny Wilkinson says. When I was part of the World Cup winning team, I had never felt so empty as I did afterwards. When we won a couple of championships, this is a year or two later, when we won a couple of championships in France, I left and there was no sunset waiting for me to stroll into. Here's a man who reached the top. You can't get better than this guy. You can't achieve more glory. And he says, I never felt so empty. Vanity. Even that kind of glory, and most small boys, including me, dream of that kind of glory. But the man who's experienced it in its most intense form says it's nothing. It just drips out through your finger, through your hands. Now, wisdom is recognizing that is reality. Don't pretend it's otherwise. And so our first lesson, I think, this morning is we're encouraged to really live in the world as it really is, not trying to pretend that it's something different, not trying to pretend that it's better than it is, not trying to pretend that it's more glamorous or more meaningful or more graspable than it actually is. So vanity is our first theme. Let's recognize that reality. The second theme is toil, hard work, striving. Let me just take you to two examples. And again, there are literally dozens of places that you could look at. Go to chapter 2 and verse 22, where he writes, "What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun?" You can almost feel the guy just wanting to sit down and go to sleep at this point as he writes this. Just want to sit down and take the weight off my feet. What has a man from all the toil and striving of heart with which he toils beneath the sun? Oh my goodness, it's so tiring. It's exhausting. Now in those days, I guess there was more of an agricultural kind of reality to life. You know, everyone's got to grow their own food. We don't have that, at least most of us don't. So we don't have exactly that kind of toil. You know, the farmer has to get up every morning at sunrise. He doesn't get holidays because the crops aren't going to look after themselves. The animals aren't going to feed themselves. And so there is that kind of aspect to their life, but the equivalent is true in all of our lives, isn't it? If you don't work hard, you don't eat. So there's always hard work to be done. If you want to have a tidy house, there's always something to be cleaned. If you want to keep your stomach full, you've always got to go to the shop to cook the food and then clear up after yourself. If you're an employee, You can't say to your boss, "Now I'm a bit tired, I'm not coming into work today." Well, you can try it once or twice, but you do it too often and you'll be out of a job. It's hard work. What about chapter 4, verses 7 and 8? "Again I saw vanity under the sun. One person who has no other, either son or brother, yet there is no end to all his toil, and his eyes are never satisfied with riches, so that he never asks, 'For whom am I toiling and depriving myself of pleasure?'" Hard work, wherever you look. Back to Johnny Wilkinson. The people who love watching rugby see him achieving this great glory on the rugby pitch, have no idea of the hours of hard work that he puts in, training, practicing, lifting weights, doing his physio, eating carefully. Hard work everywhere. And we've all had the experience, haven't we, of feeling weary at work, or feeling weary of academic assignments, school or college assignments, domestic work, or we've had that experience of working hard for a goal, reaching it, and realizing it's not enough, or straight away you've got to set another goal. Work is wearisome. And actually, it's been like that since almost the very, very beginning, hasn't it? Genesis chapter 3. Since that early moment, that first fall, God says, "You know what? It's going to be tough for you living in this world." That is the nature of life. And we're privileged, or cursed, depending on which way you look at it, to live in Greece. It's actually a mixture, isn't it? There's blessing and non-blessing living in Greece. And we love the good things about this country, and I particularly love the summer. I love the beaches, I love the heat, I love the sunshine. And Greek people, Greek young people especially, I work with students, so we see this very clearly with students. They live for the summer. Looking forward to the summer. When's the summer coming? Summer holidays. We love it. And in some ways, life here is just that cycle of working hard or putting up with everything else in between so that you can get to the next summer and enjoy your holidays. Now, there's nothing wrong with enjoying the summer. But you see that cycle, don't you? Hard work, toil, just to enjoy the next bit of pleasure. But then afterwards, you're back to the beginning again. It's not a criticism, it's just that's how life is. And the preacher wants us to recognize that life is like that. Don't pretend it isn't. And he doesn't say, try and escape from that. But he does say, that's what it's like. And you need to recognize that for what it is. Why? Why do we need to be realistic? Why does the preacher work so hard to get us to see the way that things really are? Well, it's the third thing. This is the reason. Death. We die. It's the ultimate statistic. One out of one dies. And that's the reason why life is meaningless. And it's the reason why life is hard work. Because death came into the world. And death, in a sense, rules. In a sense, death reigns over life, doesn't it? Except in Jesus. Now, to look at the theme of death and dying, again, there are dozens, literally dozens of places that you could go to. I want to take you just to two. So turn with me to chapter 2, verse 15, where we hear the preacher saying, "Then I said in my heart, what happens to the fool will happen to me also. Why then have I been so very wise? And I said in my heart that this also is vanity." What's the vanity? What's the concern that the preacher has here? What brings him down? It's like, I am a wise man, perhaps the wisest who has ever lived, and yet I'm going to die. I'm going to end up in exactly the same place as the most foolish of fools. We'll all die. So what's the point of being wise? Our end is the same. So cheerful. Isn't it cheerful? Happy Christmas. Chapter 9, verse 2. Chapter 9, verse 2. "It is the same for all, since the same event happens to the righteous and the wicked, to the good and the evil, to the clean and the unclean, to him who sacrifices and him who does not sacrifice. As the good one is, so is the sinner. And he who swears is as he who shuns an oath." What's the thing that he's talking about? What's the same? We all die. I used to think I was immortal. Not actually. I mean, I've always known that I'm a human being who one day will no longer exist. I've known that. But I used to think I was immortal. I used to have this experience of taking off on an aeroplane and thinking, this plane is not going to crash because I might. Or not in the sense of I'm kind of more special, but just I feel it in my bones. I'm not going to die. I'm young and healthy and strong and I can kind of do whatever I want except play sport for England. There is no end in sight for this human being. I used to climb mountains and walk very, very close to the edge where if I had fallen, I would definitely have died. And I distinctly remember thinking, I can do this because I am not the kind of person that's going to fall off. I don't do that anymore. I don't think like that anymore. When my plane takes off, I'm thinking, this could be the plane that goes down. When I climb mountains, I'm thinking, my foot could be the foot that slips. Death comes to us all. And wisdom is recognizing that we are mortal. Now, death, I think, is the worst of subjects. There's nothing happy. There's nothing good. There's nothing light. There's nothing enjoyable about thinking about death. And there isn't supposed to be. It's supposed to be bad. It's supposed to be wrong. It's supposed to make us despair. And when death touches any of us, we'll feel that pain. We'll feel that sense of, well, this isn't right. It's so awful, it's not right. There's nothing right about death. But turn with me, please, to chapter 12. And we're going to read a few more verses here, verses 1 to 8. Because this is the conclusion that the book is coming to you as we come to our own conclusion. Chapter 12, remember also your Creator in the days of your youth, before the evil days come and the years draw near, of which you will say, I have no pleasure in them, before the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are darkened and the clouds return after the rain, in the day when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men are bent and the grinders cease because they are few and those who look through the windows are dimmed and the doors on the street are shut, when the sound of the grinding is low and one rises up at the sound of a bird, and all the daughters of song are brought low. They are afraid also of what is high, and terrors are in the way. The almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper drags itself along, and desire fails, because man is going to his eternal home, and the mourners go about the streets. Before the silver cord is snapped, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher is shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the cistern, and the dust returns to the earth as it was, and the spirit returns to God who gave it. Vanity of vanities, says the preacher. All is vanity. That's the conclusion of the book, almost. One day, sooner or later, none of us are going to be here. Not one of us. And that's going to be sad for those who are left behind. And it's supposed to be sad for those who are left behind. It is not supposed to be okay. Recently, I read a novel by an author called Ken Follett. And he writes one particular book about an English civil servant who worked for the Queen, Queen Elizabeth I. And at the end of the book, here is this character, Ned, remembering his life. And here's how he writes. He's an old man now. His mind, sorry, this is the writer talking about this character. His mind was like a house he had spent his life furnishing. He shared this house with his family, alive and dead. There were guest rooms for important visitors. The pictures on the walls were of the times when he'd been brave, clever, or kind. They made the house a happy place. And the bad things he had done were scrawled in ugly letters on the wall of the toilet, the bathroom. His memory formed the library of the house, school in his innocent childhood, the palace in 1558, the English Channel during the battle with the Spanish. And one day, the place, this house that was his life, would fall down, as old buildings did, and then, quite quickly, it would all turn to dust. With that thought, he drifted off to sleep. It all falls down. Isn't that what the preacher wants us to understand? It all comes to an end. Nothing lasts forever. And he wants us, he needs, he's kind of pleading with us, to stop ignoring that fact, and to live in the reality of life as it really, really is. And the good news of Ecclesiastes, the good news, the gospel, if you like, of the preacher is we are not going to live forever, so face up to that. That's the good news. We're going to die. Face up to it. Why is it good news? I want to give you two reasons as we close. Why is it good news, and why is it not the case that after this terribly miserable Christmas sermon, we're not supposed to walk out of here just wanting to, I don't know, give up or be miserable or, you know, don't bother eating lunch because there's really no point, you're not going to enjoy the food anyway. Why is it good news that life is vanity, full of toil, and it ends in death? Two reasons. First reason, the book itself tells us that it's good news. Turn to chapter 12, verses 9 and 10. Because these apparently, well, this is a big surprise. Look at chapter 12, verses 9 and 10. These are words of delight. Look at this. Besides being wise, the preacher also taught the people knowledge, weighing and studying and arranging many proverbs with great care. The preacher sought to find words of delight, and uprightly he wrote words of truth. Well, words of delight, they haven't sounded like that so far. Listen to this. This is an old author and philosopher, G.K. Chesterton. This is how he writes when he became a Christian. I had tried to be happy by telling myself that man is an animal, like any other which sought its meat from God. But now, I really was happy, for I had learnt that man is a monstrosity. I had been right in feeling all things as odd, for I myself was at once worse and better than all things. The optimist's pleasure was prosaic, in other words, kind of normal, not very interesting. The optimist's pleasure, you know, the one who thought life's fine and we're great, his pleasure was prosaic, for it dwelt on the naturalness of everything. The Christian pleasure was poetic, for it dwelt on the unnaturalness of everything in the light of the supernatural. The modern philosopher had told me again and again that I was in the right place, and I have still felt depressed. But now, in becoming a Christian, I had heard that I was in the wrong place, and my soul sang for joy like a bird in spring. Do you see what he's saying? Life is not supposed to be like this, and that's why it's rubbish. Life is not supposed to be like this, and that's why things are difficult. When you see the vanity of all things around you, when you see the uselessness and the end of everything, you feel the burden of toil. When you see that death is terrible, at that point, you can be liberated by believing the good news, because you are liberated from having to pretend that life is more than it really is. You're liberated from having to say, this is great, because it isn't. You're liberated from having to say, well, this is as good as it gets, so I better enjoy it for as much as I can, because it isn't as good as it gets. This life that the book of Ecclesiastes describes is not how it's supposed to be. And that, in a weird kind of way, means that the Christian, of all people, can enjoy life. Not because it's all there is, but because it isn't all there is. That's why these are words of delight, because they set you free from pretending that life is good. We have a friend who used to live here in Athens, Heath, you'll remember, and he was once asked by a friend of his back in Canada, how do you feel about wasting the best years of your life toiling away in Athens? Because it was tough for him and his family. How do you feel about wasting the best years of your life? His reply was, these are not the best years of my life. That's when you see the good news of Ecclesiastes. These are not the best years of our lives. So, these are words of delight because they show you the reality. Second reason why it's good news is because the preacher liberates us from having to distract ourselves from reality. We spend so much of our time trying to distract ourselves, trying to find things that we enjoy, playing games, working hard and filling our bank accounts, going on those summer holidays every year, to distract ourselves from reality. That's tragic. Don't do it. Don't try and distract yourself from reality. Face up to it. Preacher liberates us from that. Stop pretending. I said there were two reasons. There's actually three why it's good news. And here's the third one, and with this we'll finish. This is good news because the wisdom of the preacher leads us and reminds us of a greater and wiser preacher, Jesus himself. Solomon was called the wisest of all people. Jesus is the one wiser than Solomon. And the wise writer here leads you to remember Jesus, who not only understands what life is like, who not only recognizes the vanity and the toil of life and the tragedy of death, but is actually able to provide a solution to that. Not by making us pretend that things are great here, but by pointing to the new creation when there will be no vanity, no meaninglessness, where there will be no toil and sweat and hard work, and, wonderfully, where there will be no death. That's the gospel according to Ecclesiastes. You don't see Jesus himself in Ecclesiastes, but you see the need for Jesus, and you see the promise of Jesus, rescuing us from death and toil and meaninglessness. And that's Christmas, isn't it? Jesus born as a baby, beginning that process of undoing all of those terrible, miserable things. So I hope you've seen some good news in Ecclesiastes. It kind of goes really bleak to really wonderful. So let's recognize the bleakness. Let's recognize the difficulty. Don't pretend it's different, but let's look forward to the joy that's ours in the future. Let's pray.